From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
We love to gossip. I think that literature is a higher form of gossip, if you like. It's gossip wrought to its finest degree.
That's acclaimed novelist Ian McEwan reflecting on the power of literature. Today we'll talk about writers and the creative process, from McEwan's investigations of human nature to the true life story of Louisa May Alcott.
She was no little woman, and her life was no children's book either. She really was an enormous personality and quite a force.
We'll also hear from legendary poet-rocker Patti Smith, who recalls her early days as a struggling artist, trying to find her own voice.
In my low periods, I wondered what was the point of creating art. For whom? Are we animating God? Are we talking to ourselves? It seemed indulgent to add to the glut unless one offered illumination.
I just don't know what to do.
But first, we turn to David Shields, a cultural critic who wants to change the way we think about art. He's written a manifesto called Reality Hunger, in which he calls for, and I'm quoting here, a deliberate unartiness, raw material, seemingly unprocessed, unfiltered, uncensored, and unprofessional. Randomness, openness to accident and serendipity, spontaneity, artistic risk, emotional urgency and intensity, a blurring of any distinction between fiction and nonfiction, the lure and blur of the real. The front and back covers of Shields' book are filled with some of the most ecstatic blurbs I've ever seen. Jonathan Lethem says the book left him astonished, intoxicated, ecstatic, overwhelmed. Both Charles Baxter and Amy Hempel call it brilliant. Philip Lopate says it's an exhilarating, audacious plunge into the controversies of fiction and nonfiction. So what's all the fuss about? To find out, Steve Paulson sat down with David Shields to talk about the purpose of art.
You say up front that this book is a manifesto, a call for artists to rethink how they handle questions about reality and fiction and originality. What's wrong with the prevailing attitudes about art?
Contemporary culture is so chaotic and multi-channeled and overwhelming and data-rich that an awful lot of the prevailing models of literature seem to me completely outmoded. For instance, the mainstream novel with its plot that coheres, with the idea that character matters in the way that pretended to matter in the 19th century bourgeois sense.
So you're saying that if a novel doesn't have some sense of reflecting on itself, I mean, sort of acknowledging that this is artifice here, that it's just escapism. It can't deal seriously with ideas?
Well, I think what happens in an awful lot of novels, and I'm not shy about mentioning names, and two I seem to mention a lot, because they're much honored writers, people like Ian McEwan or Jonathan Franzen. You know, they're thought to be something like the gold standard in British and American literature. But what I find in an awful lot of novels is that they begin with a truly interesting idea. Say, in Franzen's novel, The Corrections pretends to be a book that actually explores the notion of corrections. But really, it's just a very old-fashioned, very conventional family album.
I have to say, I read that book and enjoyed it thoroughly. What's wrong with a novel that just really explores the depths of various interesting characters and raises some intriguing issues along the way?
Nothing at all. I think of a line of Samuel Johnson who says, "A work of literature should either help us escape existence or it should teach us how to endure it." And the works that I love the most teach us how to endure it. To me, a crucial idea is this, that we're existentially alone on the planet. I can't know what you're thinking and feeling, and you can't know what I'm thinking and feeling. And the very best work constructs a bridge across the abyss of human loneliness.
You don't think Ian McEwan gets at what it means to be alive?
I know this is a minority opinion. I'm not here to be a kind of naysayer. He's obviously a good writer. Jonathan Franzen is obviously a good writer. But to me, they're antediluvian models. They are writing extraordinarily old-fashioned literature. They are essentially offering, in my view, a virtually 19th century model of literature that in no way conveys what it feels like to live at ground level in America or in England now.
Can you give me some examples of some of the fictional works or maybe non-fictional works that you really do admire?
They tend to be works that blur boundaries between genres. In my view, the best works have qualities that there's a sense of being a little bit in a dark room and you can't quite feel the walls. Is this a work of autobiography? Is it a work of confession, of documentary, of political passion? I'm a huge fan of Amy Fusselman's The Pharmacist's Mate. I love Maggie Nelson's book, Bluets. I love J.M. Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello. A very influential artist for me is Ross McAwee, the brilliant self-reflexive filmmaker, and specifically a film of his called Sherman's March, in which you can't quite tell, what is this? Is this a cri de coeur about McAwee's love life? Is it a meditation on nuclear weapons? Is it a meditation on the power of the camera? Is it about the difference between the North and South? Is it a biography of General Sherman? Well, of course, it's all of these things. And the brilliance of the work is that he shows you how the most intimate domestic details are powerfully related to extremely large political realities.
You have a really interesting take on the memoir writers who've been disgraced because it's been shown they've fabricated certain parts of their stories. James Frye, most famously. The fact that James Frye fabricated some of his material doesn't seem to bother you, even though he passed it off as true, right?
I'm no huge fan of James Frye. He's not, in my view, by any means a good writer. But it is important to me to understand that he was clearly used as a scapegoat for the culture's sins. We're obsessed with reality because we experience hardly any in our lives. And so that we live in such a completely simulated culture, completely mediated culture, that people are weirdly obsessed with trying to vet the differences between fiction and nonfiction.
And that certainly seems to explain some of the appeal of memoirs these days. I mean, there is this hunger for reality, and that's why for a lot of people, I mean, there really is it matters whether something is labeled fiction or a memoir because you approach it differently.
True enough, but memory itself is a dream machine. We need to not approach reality as if we were children, as if somehow memory is this terribly clear, transparent substance. I mean, the moment that I remember, I'm essentially am fictionalizing. And so, too, one of the first works of nonfiction ever written, Thucydides, The History of the Peloponnesian Wars, in that book, Thucydides makes up the general's speeches. I mean, to me, that's just a terribly important fact that the virtually originating work of Western culture and Western nonfiction was, in fact, a heavily fictionalized work. George Orwell's classic essay on a brutal boarding school, Such Were the Joys, was questioned in its every detail by George Orwell's classmates. It's terribly important to me to try to rescue nonfiction as art.
Does this critique apply to journalism as well, or would you say that journalists should do everything they can to get the facts right?
The critique doesn't apply to journalism. Obviously, I don't want the front page of the New York Times to be full of James Frye-like inventions. I would say, though, that it's a peculiar American fiction that the newspaper has to strike this kind of odd imperial umpire like tone of absolute impartiality, that if you read, say, Robert Fisk covering the Iraq War for a British newspaper, Fisk leads with his own subjectivity, says, you know, here I am, I was there, here are my impressions.
That makes sense to me. Sort of this whole journalistic ideal of objectivity is, to some degree, a fiction. I think all journalists recognize that. And yet, I mean, going back to the run-up of the Iraq War, there were all kinds of questions that were absolutely crucial to how the war played out. Did Saddam Hussein have any connection to 9/11? Did he have weapons of mass destruction? Did Saddam really try to buy uranium in Africa? I mean, the justification for the war turned on those questions, and each of those questions had a true or false answer.
True enough. And obviously, I wouldn't want to extend this into the realm of political theater. And there's that famous quote of a Reagan administration aide just before the Bush-Kerry election, in which he talked about, you know, that we essentially invent reality.
Now, I appreciate what you're saying, and I have to say I'm drawn to a lot of those works of art myself, the ones that blur boundaries and, you know, you sort of have to try to figure out what's going on. I do worry culturally what might happen if the distinction between fiction and nonfiction goes away, because as you say, I mean, politicians will often make the claim that they can create reality. I mean, they can create people's images, and they do, without doubt, but that's not a good thing.
No.
Is it?
I would definitely agree with you. This is a highly complicated and problematic aspect, but I think in the incredibly simulated world in which we live, this hunger for reality across many forms and many platforms is a really distinguishing part of our culture. And I guess that what I'd say is the works of art I want to espouse make as thin a membrane as possible between the reader and writer.
David Shields, talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Reality Hunger. So, is the novel an anachronism, a literary form mired in 19th century conventions? It's the charge that David Shields levels at Ian McEwan, perhaps England's most celebrated novelist. His books include Atonement and the Booker Prize-winning Amsterdam. McEwan is known for his exacting language, riveting stories, for his ability to master the arcane details of the subjects he writes about. His latest novel, Solar, is a comic tale about climate change. The main character is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist named Michael Beard, a full-blown egotist who's not shy about telling everyone else just how smart he is. Here's a scene from the novel, on a sea voyage to the Arctic, when Beard has joined a ship full of artists to learn about climate change.
Listening, as he usually did, with Jesus at his side from their corner of the mess room, Beard interjected only once on the last evening when a gangling novelist called Meredith, appearing to forget there was a physicist present, said that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which stipulated that the more one knew of a particle's position, the less one knew of its velocity and vice versa, encapsulated for our time the loss of a moral compass, the difficulty of absolute judgments. Beard was peevish in his interruption. It was worthwhile to be correct, he told this crop-haired fellow with rimless glasses. What was at issue was not velocity, but momentum. In other words, mass times velocity. At such hair-splitting, there were muted groans. Beard said that the principle had no application to the moral sphere. On the contrary, quantum mechanics was a superb predictor of the statistical probability of physical states. The novelist blushed, but would not give way. Did he not know who he was talking to? Fine, yes, okay, statistical probability, he insisted, but that was not certainty. And Beard, just finishing his eighth glass of wine and feeling nose and upper lip elevate in contempt for an ignorant trespasser on his field, said loudly that the principle was not incompatible with knowing precisely the state of, say, a photon, as long as one could observe it repeatedly. The analogy in the moral sphere might be to re-examine a moral problem a number of times before arriving at a conclusion. But this was the point. Heisenberg's principle would have application only if the sum of right plus wrong divided by the square root of 2 had any meaning. The silence in the room was not so much stunned as embarrassed. Meredith stared helplessly as Beard brought his fist down hard on the table. "So come on, tell me, let's hear you apply Heisenberg to ethics. Right plus wrong over the square root of 2. What the hell does it mean? Nothing."
"Thank you. Ian McEwan, the words self-centered are applied to your main character, Michael Beard, the central character of the novel Solar. That hardly begins to cover it, do you think? Self-centered is just the beginning, I guess, of the way you think about this guy."
"Yes, well, he certainly is selfish. Greedy, I would say, is a central part of his character makeup. A plagiarizer, a philanderer. Not a man very reflective, however self-centered he is. Generally, I'd say a scoundrel."
"So I guess the question is, what made you want to create a character like this?"
"Well, I decided I would have something of a comic victim of a fellow who flounders, as it were, in the face of this problem and reflects, I think, some of our own floundering. I don't want to suggest at all that everyone in the world is like Michael Beard. But, you know, en masse in the West, we are somewhat greedy. We consume probably more than we need. We have more than our fair share of the world's resources. At the same time, we are en masse extremely clever, and that's probably Michael Beard's redeeming quality."
"It is. He is an extraordinary intellect, except that he applies it without reflection, as you say."
"Yes, he's a physicist, and he won a Nobel Prize way back in the 80s for work modifying some conclusions that Einstein had drawn about light and electricity. He has his prize, is the greatest prize a scientist can win on the face of the earth, and really his professional life goes downhill. He simply becomes, as happens, I think, in science a fair amount, he becomes the sort of promoter of his former self. And it's one of the tragedies, or maybe it's a tragicomic situation, that the grand figures of science, especially mathematics and physics, often rest their reputations on something they did when they were, you know, a long-haired postgrad 30 years ago."
"This is not a new area of interest for you, a new character, a new story, but science in general and the conflict, or at least the rubbing together of arts and science, is a kind of through line in the novels that you've written. But here you seem to have really studied the science, especially the science of climate change."
"Well, you know, novels are, to some extent, all smoke and mirrors. Although I mentioned some of the outer reaches of maths, particularly superstring theory and M theory, I don't actually understand it at all. It's incredibly difficult. And even some of the people I was talking to, I wondered if they understood it. I mean, they can apply it, some of these systems, mathematical systems. But when I say to them, do you really understand what it would mean, a world of 11 dimensions, which seems to be necessary for elements of string theory? They say no. No one could get their mind around that. We just know how to. We've invented this brilliant piece of maths, and we can apply it."
"What drives you to write? Where do your stories come from?"
"Oh, I was worried you would ask me that. I don't really know. I hang about till something begins to impel me."
"Well, I'm curious, I guess, whether it's a desire to tell stories, or do you see literature as a means to an end?"
"Well, I think of literature, and particularly the novel, as an investigation of human nature, primarily. And so when I set out on a novel, I think I'm setting out on a kind of, almost like a private eye setting out on an investigation, you know, taking on a case. It's also a journey that I might have only the roughest guide for."
"Your novels are all explorations of human nature, as you say, investigations of human nature. They're also explorations of who people are, and that, no matter what the subject, seems to be the driving force. Am I close in saying that?"
"Yes. I mean, we clearly are a social creature. We live in groups. Our ancestors, our primate ancestors, lived in troops, in groups. We're deeply fascinated by each other. We love to gossip. I think that literature is a higher form of gossip, if you like. It's gossip wrought to its finest degree. We love to dissect each other's motivations and characters and fates and histories. The novel, I think, is just an irreplaceable means of knowing what it's like to be someone else. For that reason, I think it's been very robust. You know, it's resisted movies and TV and now the internet to obliterate it.
Some novelists create, or I guess you'd say, compelling places that afterwards just seem to have been kind of nice places to visit. You visit those places, but it's clear all along that you're driving a story forward. You never forget about beginnings, middles, and ends.
Well, you know, Henry James wrote a famous essay called The Art of Fiction, in which he said the first duty of the novelist is to be interesting. Now, whether James always followed his own advice, I'm not sure, but it's a very simple remark. I've always tried to live by it. I think curiosity, which some people regard as a rather low motivator in art and in literary fiction, but I think it's vital. There are many demands on people's time. A 100,000-word novel, let's say, takes 15 or 20 hours to read, and you've got to invite people in. I mean, if you think of a novel as in architectural terms, that the door has to kind of open into somewhere interesting, and curiosity has to be tweaked early on. And so I do like plots, I do like tricks and turns, I do like to alter the beat or pulse, the drumbeat of prose. I do like to have characters suddenly put to the test, to have a crisis, to have something occur that throws them off course. But most of all, I want the reader to be curious. I'm not saying that all good fiction has to be what was called a page-turner, but there has to be something implicitly demanding of further reading, of just that impelling matter of simple curiosity that to drive things forward. And plots and characters are the best way to do that, in my view.
Is that part of what happens to you when you're writing, curiosity to see how it ends? Or do you know when you begin a story where it is going to begin and end?
I generally, although not always, but I generally have a sense of where this is going to end up. For example, in this novel, I didn't know how I was going to get there precisely, but I knew that I wanted to be in a small town in the New Mexican desert, and the sky would have to darken with lots of chickens coming home to roost for Michael Beard, and that it would end in some chaos.
But you haven't given anything away by saying that, have you?
No, not too much away. But anyway, quite what those elements would be, I did not know. So I travel with a sketch map, if you like. But I hope, I mean, a good morning's work or a good day's work for me would be bound to contain some element of surprise. It might only be just a noun adjective, an adjective noun coupling that gives me some pleasure, or it might be that a new character is just edged onto the page, or it might be that I've suddenly seen ahead to where something might lead.
That's Ian McEwan. His latest novel is called Solar. So what do you think makes a great novel? A good story? Compelling characters? Or do you want something more? A book that breaks new artistic ground? If you'd like to share your thoughts, you can email us through our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Louisa May Alcott's Little Women is one of America's most beloved novels. The story's main character, Jo March, has inspired legions of strong women all over the world, from Hillary Clinton and Sandra Day O'Connor to Simone de Beauvoir and J.K. Rowling. It's no surprise when you think about Jo March's determination.
Jo, tell me what happens next. After the Duke turns his back on his family fortune and saves Lady Zara.
Don't know. It's all murder and gore. The damsel's in distress.
Oh, I love your damsel's in distress.
Oh, Beth, truly, I don't know if I could ever be good like Marmee. I rather crave violence. If only I could be like Father and go to war and stand up to the lions of injustice.
And so Marmee does in her own way.
Yes. But I want to do something different. I don't know what it is yet, but I'm on the watch for it.
You'll find it, Joe.
A scene from the 1994 movie Little Women, starring Winona Ryder. The novel is actually an idealized version of Louisa May Alcott's own family. Alcott's true passion was to write racy thrillers, which she did, often using pseudonyms. Stories about scheming governesses, transvestites, even hashish. And Strange Chimps wanted to find out Alcott's real story, so she sat down with her biographer, Harriet Risen.
All the world knows Louisa May Alcott as the author of Little Women, but your biography suggests that the problem is that that tends to be all we know about her. Were you out to rescue her, in a sense, from her own reputation?
Yes, in a word. She was no little woman, and her life was no children's book, either. Mm. She is so much more. She really was an enormous personality and quite a force.
So not only not a sweet, sentimental writer of stories for girls, but in many ways a proto-feminist.
Definitely a feminist. Her mother and father actually were among the founders of the Massachusetts Woman's Suffrage Society. She did start a voter registration drive. And the suffrage, as you know, I'm sure, didn't come for another 40 years.
Right. Well, even as a girl, Louisa May Alcott was pushing boundaries. I mean, somewhat like her character, Jo March, she was a tempestuous tomboy kind of girl.
That's right. And she also seemed to have been born violent. She had tremendous aggression in her. And as a child, she hit everybody in the family. And she had a power struggle with her sister, Anna, who was about 15 months older than she was. And when she was about 2 or 3, she beat up Anna.
It's interesting reading some of the documents that you quote in the biography there, you know, diaries that Bronson Alcott kept and close observations of all of his children, their letters between the parents, Louise's own diary entries later, they kind of add up to a portrait of a girl who continually felt like a bad girl and who felt guilty a great deal for her own nature, her own temperament.
Yes, she did. She was made to feel guilty for it by her father, who pretty much equated being loved with being well-behaved. And Louisa wanted to be loved.
And yet Bronson Alcott himself, he was an educator and was considered to be kind of at the far extreme in terms of progressive attitudes toward education, wasn't he?
Oh, so far to the extreme that it's still shocking to me now. He banished rote learning. He invented recess. He taught sex education. And he admitted a black girl to the school 25 years before slavery was ended.
Well, of course, that was the end of his pupils.
That's right.
I mean, didn't all the other parents pretty much pull all the other students out?
Yes. The parents sent a delegation and asked him to please expel the child, and he refused, even though he knew what would happen. He was a man of great principle and ideals and spectacularly impractical.
Well, it seems as though one of the stories you tell about Louisa, the story seems to be that she adored her father, she badly wanted his love, suffered by feeling unworthy of his love, and at the same time was angry and wanted to transgress. So there was this push-pull kind of thing going
Absolutely.
On for her.
Yes, she wanted to be independent. She wanted to live free. She said, I love luxury, but freedom and independence better. So people do think of her as sticking around home, but really she did that because they needed her, and she supported them all. Her moods, which were dramatic, really some people might say she was manic depressive or bipolar.
Her style of writing, didn't she? I guess when she was kind of on and writing, she would write intensively for days and days, and then she'd have a kind of crash?
That's right. And at one point, she came back from Europe, and for 6 months, she wrote nonstop. It's amazing. If you look at a list of everything she published in a given year, you won't believe it. But then for 6 months, she stays in her room. And she says, can't get up, you know. And then the next month says, ditto, ditto. And then around April, she says, tried to get up, but fell back worse than ever. Finally, in June, she picks herself up and she recommences writing.
Well, you mentioned her manic fits of writing. I mean, that's one of the other discoveries that's been made about her in our time is just how prolific a writer she was. You know, if you look just at her output as a children's literature writer, it's not that great. I don't know how many children's books are there that she wrote.
She wrote eight.
Eight.
But she wrote for children because it earned her money. And before that, she'd written many, many thrillers and hospital sketches she wrote. That's her account of being a nurse in the Civil War. She wrote Moods, which was a novel that she worked on for 20 years off and on. And she wrote so many thrillers, at least 30, that have been discovered so far.
Well, that's what we should talk about, because that's
and poem.
You know, a kind of secret identity that she had as a writer of these lurid thrillers under another name, right?
Usually, actually anonymous. One was published as A Lady from Massachusetts. She also used Flora Fairchild, which was quite transcendental, and A.M. Barnard. And A.M. Barnard turned out to be the clue to the rediscovery of her thrillers, which were rumored to exist but were not really found until 1943 and weren't published till 1976.
It's kind of a dramatic story of how they were found also.
Yes. Dr. Leona Rosenberg and Madeline B. Stern. Stern was Louise's first full-length biographer, discovered in Houghton Library some correspondence between a publisher who asked Louisa for any more stories she could send along the line of Behind a Mask, under the name A.M. Barnard. So they knew there was Behind a Mask by A.M. Barnard, and boy, is it a doozy of a thriller. It is. Because it's like a feminist Jane Eyre. The governess is a complete fraud. She is an actress, and she wears a wig and false teeth. And although she claims to be 17, she is really an old woman of 30 at least. That's what it says. She goes into this family determined to marry one of the wealthy men in that family because her years as an actress are older. So you're rooting for her. You want her to succeed. She does.
And yet she's a villainous, an adventurer.
That's right. That's right. Isn't that? That's a complete subversion of those usual governess stories.
So tell me about the other thrillers that she wrote. Did they often feature women who broke the rules?
Oh, yes. There was transvestite one. There's a number of them where they take opium or are actresses, which was not an approved profession. And she wrote about hashish.
So which was the real Louisa May Alcott, the writer who wrote about transgression and addiction and obsession, or the creator of Little Women?
Not the creator of Little Women. No, she did that for the money. She took a royalty. Her publisher suggested she take a royalty arrangement, although it was very new, and really, that was a jackpot. She became a wealthy woman.
But how ironic that the book that she wrote essentially out of a false self was the one that brought her the success that she dreamed of.
Well, I think she started it as a false self, but she got into it. I think what was hard for her, perhaps, I don't know, was smoothing over the rough edges of her very difficult childhood. The March family and Little Women live in a kind of genteel poverty, and they have a servant. And the Alcott family lived in grueling poverty where they were living on bread and water for long stretches of time, or an apple and bread. And she had to work. Louisa, from the age of 13, started earning money. So it's very much idealized and romanticized in Little Women, although I do think she gets across the feelings and, for lack of a better word, maybe the lessons that she feels are valuable.
Well, so far, we're kind of sketching a portrait of a woman who struggled between two different sorts of identities for much of her life, the good girl and the breaker of rules and boundaries. Did she ever manage to integrate those two different sides of herself?
Well, I would say as a nurse in the Civil War, would be the time when she integrated those parts of herself. She volunteered and went down to Washington right after the Battle of Fredericksburg, where some 10,000 Union men were wounded. And within 3 days, she found herself assisting at amputations without anesthesia, washing men, you know, taking their clothes off and washing them, being very intimate with them in that way. But she was very angry. She was very angry at the South. And on the way down, she passed a spot where one of the Massachusetts regiments had been attacked by a Confederate mob. And she says something like, "I wanted to throw a stone at somebody hard." So she has that fist, you know, there. At the same time, she's wearing a nurse's apron and doing a very good job of being a gentle, kind nurse.
That's Harriet Risen talking with Anne Strainchamps. Her biography is called Louisa May Alcott, The Woman Behind Little Women. Up next, another woman who shook up the world, Patti Smith. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Do you recognize this voice?
Horses, 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 coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, horses.
That's Patti Smith, who's been called the godmother of punk. The intense hypnotic songs in her first album, Horses, created a new kind of music, a fusion of poetry and rock and roll. To hear that self-assured voice is a far cry from the Patti Smith of just a few years earlier, the South Jersey girl who dreamed of becoming an artist. It's the story she tells in her remarkable memoir, Just Kids.
In the spring of 1967, I assessed my life. I had dropped out of teacher's college, having not the discipline, the focus, nor the money I needed to continue. I was holding a temporary minimum wage job in a textbook factory in Philadelphia. My immediate concern was where to go next and what to do when I got there. I held to the hope that I was an artist. I knew I would never be able to afford to go to art school and had to make a living. My few comrades had moved to New York City to write poetry and study art, and I felt very much alone.
Patti Smith went off to New York with little more than a dream. She met another young aspiring artist, Robert Mapplethorpe, who would later become famous for his revolutionary style of photography. They became lovers, and both would eventually explode onto the New York art scene. Steve Paulson sat down with Patti Smith to talk about those early years.
You write about how you always longed to enter the fraternity of the artist, even when you were very young. Why did art have so much allure for you?
It just was the most familiar thing to me. You know, the thing that I was most attracted to as a child, even a toddler, was the book. I loved to read. When I saw art for the first time in person at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, I wanted to commit it. It seemed totally familiar to me.
And clearly, growing up where you did was not the best environment to pursue an artistic career. So you boarded a bus to New York City. You had no money, no job prospects, no place to stay. What were you looking for?
Freedom, a job. I mean, in New York City, I didn't have to worry about how I was dressed, if I was offending anybody just by, you know, not teasing my hair or wearing the right clothes. You know, you could go to New York City and nobody cared. They didn't care how you looked, or as long as you didn't bother anybody, you could do what you wanted.
But this must have been tough, especially those first weeks you were there. I mean, you were sleeping on the streets, scrounging for food. How long did it take for you to feel grounded, to feel like you belong there?
Well, I guess I most felt grounded when Robert and I got our own place, which, you know, it was only a couple of months. I came from a lower middle class family. We were no strangers to being hungry or strife. My father was on strike a lot. My mother worked really hard. She did ironing. She was a waitress. She had four children. So it wasn't like such a big deal to me.
How did you meet Robert Mapplethorpe?
I met him in Brooklyn near Pratt. I had some friends who lived at Pratt, and I thought maybe they could give me a helping hand, maybe give me a place to stay the night. And I went to their address, but they had left. And the new fella that lived there said, well, go and ask the boy, my roommate, he might know. And I opened a door and found the boy sleeping. And when I walked in, I looked down at him, and he woke up and smiled at me. And that's how I met Robert.
Hmm. The way you tell the story, it's remarkable how quickly you two connected. It seems like you recognized almost immediately that you were kindred spirits.
Yes, we were very two of a kind, both in appearance and desire and the fact that neither one of us had anything. Robert didn't have his own place to live. He had left the ROTC and therefore lost his scholarship at the art school. He was trying to figure his life out. You know, both of us were, you know, at this pivotal point in our young lives, both of us 20 years old. We just, I don't know, we just recognized one another. The city was a real city, shifty and sexual. I was lightly jostled by small herds of flushed young sailors looking for action on 42nd Street, with its rows of X-rated movie houses, brassy women, glittering souvenir shops, and hot dog vendors. I walked for hours from park to park. In Washington Square, one could still feel the character of Henry James and the presence of the author himself. Entering the perimeter of the White Arch, one was greeted by the sounds of bongos and acoustic guitars, protest singers, political arguments, activists leafleting, older chess players challenged by the young. The open atmosphere was something I had not experienced. Simple freedom that did not seem to be oppressive to anyone.
You ended up sharing an apartment with Robert, which also became a kind of art studio for the two of you. Did you see yourselves as artists back then? I mean, back when you were 20 years old?
Well, Robert certainly did. Robert was completely formed as an artist. He continued to evolve, but he had a full concept of himself as an artist. I was still on the tightrope, you know, thinking of myself more as an apprentice, but he instilled a lot of confidence in me. But we worked all the time. I mean, we had nothing. We had no TV, no telephone. I mean, basically, we had an old record player and a handful of records and our books and each other.
What do you think Robert was looking for in art?
Oh, absolutely something that hadn't been seen before. So Robert was always striving to open up new territory.
What about you?
I have a different, I guess I'm a more literary worker. I just want to do things that I think are good. I didn't have the same ambition to rip the seams of the art world. I just wanted to do things that I thought were aesthetically fine. In my low periods, I wondered what was the point of creating art. For whom? Are we animating God? Are we talking to ourselves? And what was the ultimate goal? To have one's work caged in art's great zoos, the Modern, the Met, the Louvre? I craved honesty, yet found dishonesty in myself. Why commit to art? For self-realization or for itself? It seemed indulgent to add to the glut unless one offered illumination. Often I'd sit and try to write or draw, but all of the manic activity in the streets coupled with the Vietnam War made my efforts seem meaningless. I could not identify with political movements. In trying to join them, I felt overwhelmed by yet another form of bureaucracy. I wondered if anything I did mattered. Robert had little patience with these little introspective bouts of mine. He never seemed to question his artistic drives, and by his example, I understood that what matters is the work, the string of words propelled by God becoming a poem, the wave and weave of color and graphite scrawled upon the sheet that magnifies his motion, to achieve within the work a perfect balance of faith and execution. From this state of mind comes a light, life charged.
You and Robert Mapplethorpe moved to the Chelsea Hotel, which was famous for the bohemian artists and eccentric characters who either lived there or passed through. William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Diane Arbus, Janis Joplin. I had the sense that that was the perfect place for you at that point in your life.
I think the Chelsea Hotel was indeed the perfect place for Robert and I because we had no money. We didn't belong to any specific community. We were entirely both dependent on each other, but independent of anyone else. And I think that the Chelsea offered us shelter, an instant community, and a plethora of mentors. I mean, for me especially, I got to know Gregory Corso and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg there. We met people from the arts, people who were both struggling and people who had some success. The community at the Chelsea was not broken down by things like celebrity. If you had a little more money, you had a bigger room.
Now, there are a few artists who kind of loom over your memoir. One is Andy Warhol. And you say that Robert Mapplethorpe became fixated on trying to meet him and to be recognized by him. Why did Andy Warhol have such allure at that time in New York?
Well, Andy Warhol was like the king of New York. He had the mantle after Marcel Duchamp. Robert recognized many things about the modern world in terms of art, the high society aspects of art, you know, the responsibility to do not only great work, but to do something new. And Warhol, as Duchamp, had done that.
Now, this was a period of tremendous personal transformation, and it was certainly true for Robert as well. He came to realize that he was primarily attracted to men, and of course he became famous later for his homoerotic photographs. That must have been hard for you to realize that his interests primarily lay elsewhere.
Well, yeah. You know, he was my boyfriend, and it was hard for him too, though. We loved each other. We really cared about each other. And Robert's nature drew him away, but it didn't lessen his love for me. We didn't have a fight. We had to weather that together because our bond was much deeper than one sexual persuasion.
The wall is high, the black bond, the baby in my arms in a swaddling clothes and under. That the sky will split and the planets will shift. Bows of jade will drop and existence will stop. Little sister, the sky is falling.
But during this time, you were also writing poetry, and there came a point where you started performing poetry up on stage, and then you were accompanied by music. Was this a natural progression for you to get up there in front of people and to perform what you had written?
Well, I don't know if it was natural, but it evolved honestly. I think what made it a speedier process, considering I had no particular ambition, is that I'm very comfortable getting up in front of people. I wouldn't say that I'm an exhibitionist, so the stage, you know, is not a foreign place to me. I just had to figure out what I was going to do on it.
Of course, you eventually became famous for fusing poetry with rock and roll. Did you see yourself as a musician back then in your early days?
No.
So that was something really new for you.
Well, I never considered myself a musician. I can hardly play an instrument. I mean, I can play really good feedback, but I only know a handful of chords. I can improvise on piano, and I can improvise on clarinet. I play by ear, but I would hardly call myself a musician.
you certainly have done very well fronting a rock band if you are not.
Well, I consider myself a performer, so I know that I can do that.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me.
Now, over the years, you and Robert Mapplethorpe went on to lead your separate lives. You married and moved to Detroit. You always remained close. And when you heard that Robert was dying of AIDS in the late 80s, you went back to New York and visited him. And you have an extraordinarily moving passage near the end of your book describing that visit. Could you read that?
In mid-February, driven by a sense of urgency, Fred and I flew to New York, and I went to see Robert by myself. It seemed so quiet. I realized it was the absence of his terrible cough. I lingered by his empty wheelchair. Lynn Davis's image of an iceberg rising like a torso turned by nature dominated the wall. He had a white cat, a white snake, and there was a brochure of white stereo systems lying on his white table that he had designed. I noticed he had added a white square in the blackness surrounding his image of a sleeping Cupid. There was no one present save his nurse, and she left us to ourselves. I stood by his bed and took his hand. We stayed like that for a long time, not saying anything. Suddenly he looked up and said, "Patty, did art get us?" I looked away, not really wanting to think about it. "I don't know, Robert. I don't know."
Patty Smith, reading from her memoir, Just Kids. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've just heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Portrait of the Artist, number 418A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.